I'm fearful of the kind that comes from self-delusion. Marvin Davis, in the New England Journal of Medicine, talking about the cure for cancer. The iron is hot, and this is the time to pound without cessation. Sidney Farber to Mary Lasker, September 1965. One swallow is a coincidence, but two swallows make summer. By the autumn of 1968, as the trials in Bethesda and in Memphis announced their noteworthy successes, the landscape of cancer witnessed a seismic shift. In the late 50s, as DeVita recalled, it took plain old courage to be a chemotherapist, and certainly the courage of the conviction that cancer would eventually succumb to drugs. Clearly, proof was necessary. Just a decade later, the burden of proof had begun to shift dramatically. The cure of lymphoblastic leukemia with high-dose chemotherapy might have been dismissed as a biological fluke, but the success of the same strategy in Hodgkin's disease made it seem like a general principle. A revolution has been set in motion, DeVita wrote. Kenneth Endicott, the NCI director, concurred. The next step, the complete cure, is almost sure to follow. In Boston, Farber greeted the news by celebrating the way he knew best, by throwing a massive public party. The symbolic date for the party was not hard to come by. In September 1968, the Jimmy Fund turned 21. The Jimmy Fund was launched in May 1948. September 1968 marked its 21st year. The date of Jimmy's birthday was arbitrarily assigned by Farber. Farber recast the occasion as the symbolic 21st birthday of Jimmy, a coming-of-age moment for his child with cancer. The Imperial Ballroom of the Statler Hotel, outside which the Variety Club had once positioned its baseball-shaped donation box for Jimmy in the 1950s, was outfitted for a colossal celebration. The guest list included Farber's typically glitzy retinue of physicians, scientists, philanthropists, and politicians. Mary Lasker couldn't attend the event, but she sent Elmer Bobst from the ACS. Zubrod flew up from the NCI. Kenneth Endicott came from Bethesda. Conspicuously missing from the list was the original Jimmy himself, Einar Gustafsson. Farber knew of Jimmy's whereabouts. He was alive and well, Farber told the press opaquely, but deliberately chose to shroud the rest in anonymity. Jimmy, Farber insisted, was an icon, an abstraction. The real Jimmy had returned to a private, cloistered life on a farm in rural Maine, where he now lived with his wife and three children, his restored normalcy a sign of victory against cancer. He was 32 years old. No one had seen or photographed him for nearly two decades. At the end of the evening, as the demitasse cups were being wheeled away, Farber rose to the stage in the full glare of the lights. Jimmy's clinic, he said, now stood at the most fortunate time in the history of science and medicine. Institutions and individuals across the nation, the Variety Club, the motion picture industry, the Boston Braves, the Red Sox, the world of sports, the press, the television, the radio, had come together around cancer. What was being celebrated in the ballroom that evening, Farber announced, was not an individual's birthday, but the birth of a once beleaguered community that had clustered around a disease. The community now felt on the verge of a breakthrough. As DeVita described it, the missing piece of the therapeutic puzzle, effective chemotherapy for systemic cancers, had been discovered. High-dose combination chemotherapy would cure all cancers, once the right combinations had been found. The chemical arsenal, one writer noted, now in the hands of prescribing physicians, gives them every bit as much power as the heroic surgeon wielding the knife at the turn of the century. The prospect of a systematic solution to a cure intoxicated oncologists. It equally intoxicated the political forces that had converged around cancer. Potent, hungry and expansive, the word war captured the essence of the anti-cancer campaign. Wars demand combatants, weapons, soldiers, the wounded, survivors, bystanders, collaborators, strategists, sentinels, victories, and it was not hard to find a metaphorical analog to each of these for this war as well. Wars also demand a clear definition of an enemy. They imbue even formless adversaries with forms. So cancer, a shape-shifting disease of colossal diversity, was recast as a single, monolithic entity. It was one disease. As Isaiah Fidler, the influential Houston oncologist, described it succinctly, cancer had to possess one cause, one mechanism, and one cure. If clinical oncologists had multi-drug cytotoxic chemotherapy to offer as their unifying solution for cancer, one cure, then cancer scientists had their own theory to advance for its unifying cause, viruses. The grandfather of this theory was Peyton Rouse, a stooping, white-haired chicken virologist who had been roosting quietly in a laboratory at the Rockefeller Institute in New York until he was dragged out of relative oblivion in the 1960s. In 1909, note that date, Halstead had just wrapped up his study of the mastectomy. Neely was yet to advertise his reward for the cure for cancer. Then a 30-year-old scientist freshly launching his lab at the Rockefeller Institute, Peyton Rouse had been brought a tumor growing on the back of a hen of a black-and-white species of chicken called Plymouth Rock. A rare tumor in a chicken might have left others unimpressed, but the indefatigable Rouse secured a $200 grant to study the chicken cancer. Soon he had categorized the tumor as a sarcoma, a cancer of the connective tissues, with sheet upon sheet of rhomboid, fox-eyed cells invading the tendons and muscle. Rouse's initial work on the chicken sarcoma was thought to have little relevance to human cancers. In the 1920s, the only known causes of human cancer were environmental carcinogens, such as radium, recall Marie Curie's leukemia, or organic chemicals, such as paraffin and dye byproducts, that were known to cause solid tumors. In the late 18th century, an English surgeon named Percival Pott had argued that cancer of the scrotum, endemic among chimney sweeps, was caused by chronic exposure to chimney soot and smoke. We will meet Pott again later. These observations had led to a theory called the somatic mutation hypothesis of cancer. The somatic theory of cancer argued that environmental carcinogens such as soot or radium somehow permanently altered the structure of the cell and thus caused cancer. But the precise nature of the alteration was unknown. Clearly, soot, paraffin, and radium possess the capacity to alter a cell in some fundamental way to generate a malignant cell. But how could such a diverse range of insults all converge on the same pathological insult? Perhaps a more systematic explanation was missing. A deeper, more fundamental theory of carcinogenesis. In 1910, unwittingly, Rouse threw the somatic theory into grave doubt. Experimenting with the spindle cell sarcoma, Rouse injected the tumor in one chicken into another chicken and found that the cancer could be transmitted from one bird to another. "I have propagated a spindle cell sarcoma of the common fowl into its fourth generation," he wrote. "The neoplasm grows rapidly, infiltrates, metastasizes, and remains true to type." This was curious, but nonetheless still understandable. Cancer was a disease of cellular origin, and transferring cells from one organism to another might have been expected to transmit the cancer. But then Rouse stumbled on an even more peculiar result. Shuttling tumors from one bird to another, he began to pass the cells through a set of filters, a series of finer and finer cellular sieves, until the cells had been eliminated from the mix, and all that was left was the filtrate derived from the cells. Rouse expected the tumor transmission to stop, but instead the tumors continued propagating with a ghostly efficacy, at times even increasing in transmissibility as the cells had progressively vanished. The agent responsible for carrying the cancer, Rouse concluded, was not a cell or an environmental carcinogen, but some tiny particle lurking within a cell. The particle was so small that it could easily pass through most filters and keep producing cancer in animals. The only biological particle that had these properties was a virus. His virus was later called Rouse sarcoma virus, or RSV for short. The discovery of RSV, the first cancer-causing virus, felled a deep blow to the somatic mutation theory and set off a frantic search for more cancer viruses. The causal agent for cancer, it seemed, had been found. In 1935, a colleague of Rouse's named Richard Shope reported a papillomavirus that caused wart-like tumors in cottontail rabbits. 10 years later, in the mid-1940s, came news of a leukemia-causing virus in mice and then in cats. But still no sign of a bona fide cancer virus in humans. In 1958, after nearly a three-decade effort, the hunt finally yielded an important prize. An Irish surgeon, Dennis Burkitt, discovered an aggressive form of lymphoma, now called Burkitt's lymphoma, that occurred endemically among children in the malaria-ridden belt of sub-Saharan Africa. The pattern of distribution suggested an infectious cause. When two British virologists analyzed the lymphoma cells from Africa, they discovered an infectious agent lodged inside them, not malaria parasites, but a human cancer virus. The new virus was named Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV. EBV is more familiar to us as the virus that causes infectious mononucleosis, or mono. The grand total of cancer-causing viruses in humans now stood at one. But the modesty of that number aside, the cancer virus theory was in full spate now, in part because viruses were the new rage in all of medicine. Viral diseases, having been considered incurable for centuries, were now becoming potentially preventable. The polio vaccine, introduced in the summer of 1952, had been a phenomenal success. And the notion that cancer and infectious diseases could eventually collapse into a single pathological entity was simply too seductive to resist. "Cancer may be infectious," a Life magazine cover piece asserted in 1962. Rouse received hundreds of letters from anxious men and women asking about exposures to cancer-causing bacteria or viruses. Speculation soon inched toward hysteria and fear. If cancer was infectious, some wondered, why not quarantine patients to prevent its spread? Why not send cancer patients to sanitation wards or isolation facilities where TB and smallpox victims had once been confined? One woman who believed that she had been exposed to a coughing lung cancer patient wrote, "Is there something I can do to kill the cancer germ? Can the rooms be fumigated? Should I give up my lease and move out?" If the cancer germ had infected one space most acutely, it was the imagination of the public, and equally, the imagination of researchers. Farber turned into a particularly fervent believer. In the early 1960s, goaded by his insistence, the NCI inaugurated a special virus cancer program, a systematic hunt for human cancer viruses patterned explicitly after the chemotherapy discovery program. The project snowballed into public prominence, gathering enormous support. Hundreds of monkeys at the NCI-funded lab were inoculated with human tumors with the hopes of turning the monkeys into viral incubators for vaccine development. Unfortunately, the monkeys failed to produce even a single cancer virus, but nothing dimmed the optimism. Over the next decade, the cancer virus program siphoned away more than 10% of the NCI contract budget, nearly $500 million. In contrast, the Institute's cancer nutrition program, meant to evaluate the role of diet in cancer, a question of at least equal import, received 1/20th of that allocation. Peyton Rouse was rehabilitated into the scientific mainstream and levitated into permanent scientific sainthood. In 1966, having been overlooked for a full 55 years, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. On the evening of December 10th, at the ceremony in Stockholm, he rose to the podium like a resurrected Messiah. Rouse acknowledged in his talk that the virus theory of cancer still needed much more work and clarity. "Relatively few viruses have any connection with the production of neoplasms," Rouse said. But bulldoggish and unwilling to capitulate, Rouse lambasted the idea that cancer could be caused by something inherent to the cells, such as a genetic mutation. A favorite explanation has been that oncogenes cause alterations in the genes of the cells of the body, somatic mutations, as these are termed. But numerous facts, when taken together, decisively exclude this supposition. He groused elsewhere, "What have been the fruits of this somatic mutation hypothesis? Most serious of all the results of the somatic mutation hypothesis has been its effect on research workers. It acts as a tranquilizer on those who believe it." Rouse had his own tranquilizer to offer, a unifying hypothesis that viruses caused cancer. And many in his audience, in no mood for caveats and complexities, were desperate to swallow his medicine. The somatic mutation theory of cancer was dead. The scientists who had studied environmental carcinogenesis needed to think of other explanations why radium or soot might cause cancer. Perhaps, the virus theorists reasoned, these insults activated endogenous viruses. Two superficial theories were thus stitched audaciously and prematurely into one comprehensive whole. One offered a cause: viruses caused cancer, although a vast majority of them were yet undiscovered. The second offered a cure. Particular combinations of cytotoxic poisons would cure cancer, although specific combinations for the vast majority of cancers were yet undiscovered. Viral carcinogenesis clearly demanded a deeper explanation. How might viruses, elemental microbes floating from cell to cell, cause so profound a change in a cell's physiology as to create a malignant cell? The success of cytotoxic chemotherapy provoked equally fundamental questions. Why had a series of rather general poisons cured some forms of cancer, while leaving other forms completely unscathed? Obviously, a more fundamental explanation lurked beneath all of this, an explanation that would connect cause and cure. So some researchers urged patience, diligence, and time. The program directed by the National Cancer Institute has been derided as one that puts the cart before the horse by searching for a cure before knowing the cause, Kenneth Endicott, the NCI director, acknowledged in 1963. "We have certainly not found a cure for cancer. We have a dozen chemicals which are somewhat better than those known before the program began, but none are dramatically better. They prolong the patient's life somewhat and make him more comfortable, but that is all." But the Laskerites had little time for such nuanced descriptions of progress. This cart would have to drag the horse. "The iron is hot, and this is the time to pound without cessation," Farber wrote to Lasker. The groundwork for an all-out battle had already been laid. All that was necessary was to put pressure on Congress to release funds. No large mission or goal-directed effort against cancer, supported with adequate funds, has ever been organized, Mary Lasker announced in an open letter to Congress in 1969. Lasker's thoughts were echoed by Solomon Garb, a little-known professor of pharmacology at the University of Missouri, who shot to prominence by publishing the book Cure for Cancer, a National Goal, in 1968. The theme of this book, Garb began, is that the time has come for a closer look at cancer research and for a new consolidation of effort aimed at cure or control of cancer. A major hindrance to cancer effort has been a chronic, severe shortage of funds, a situation that is not generally recognized. It is not enough, however, to point this out or to repeat it. It is also necessary to explain how additional funds would be used, what projects they would pay for, why such projects deserve support, and where the skilled scientists and technicians to do the work would come from. Garb's book was described as a springboard to progress, and the Laskerites certainly sprang. As with Farber, a doctor's word was the ultimate prescription. That Garb had prescribed precisely the strategy advocated by the Laskerites instantly transformed him, in their eyes, into a messianic figure. His book became their Bible. Religious movements and cults are often founded on a tetrad of elements: a prophet, a prophecy, a book, and a revelation. By the summer of 1969, the Cancer Crusade had acquired three of these four essential elements. Its prophet was Mary Lasker, the woman who had guided it out of the dark wilderness of the 1950s into national prominence just two decades later. Its prophecy was the cure for childhood leukemia, inaugurated by Farber's experiments in Boston and ending with Pinkel's astonishing successes in Memphis. Its book was Garb's Cure for Cancer. The final missing element was a revelation, a sign that would augur the future and capture the imagination of the public. In the spirit of all great revelations, this one would also appear unexpectedly and mystically out of the blue. It would apparition, quite literally, from the heavens. At 4:17 p.m. EDT on July 20, 1969, a 15-ton spacecraft moved silently through the cold, thin atmosphere above the moon and landed on a rocky basalt crater on the lunar surface. A vast, barren landscape, a magnificent desolation, stretched out around the spacecraft. "It suddenly struck me," one of the two astronauts would recall, "that that tiny pea, pretty and blue, was the Earth. I put up my thumb and shut one eye, and my thumb blotted out the planet." On that pea-sized blue planet glimmering on the horizon, this was a moment of reckoning. It was a stunning scientific and intellectual accomplishment, Time reported in July 1969, for a creature who, in the space of a few million years, an instant in evolutionary chronology, emerged from primeval forests to hurl himself at the stars. It was, in any event, a shining reaffirmation of the optimistic premise that whatever man imagines, he can bring to pass. The Cancer Crusaders could not have asked for a more exuberant vindication for their own project. Here was another programmatic effort, planned, targeted, goal-oriented, and intensely focused, that had delivered its results in record time. When Max Faget, the famously taciturn engineer of the Apollo program, was later asked to comment on the principal scientific challenge of the moon landing, he could only come up with a single word: propulsion. The impression was that the moonwalk had turned out to be a technological cakewalk, no more complicated than building a more powerful jet plane, magnifying it several dozenfold and pointing it vertically at the moon. The Laskerites, transfixed in front of their flickering television sets in Boston, Washington, and New York on the evening of the moon landing, were primed to pick up on all these analogies. Like Faget, they believed that the missing element in the Cancer Crusade was some sort of propulsion, a simple internal vertical thrust that would transform the scale and scope of their efforts and catapult them toward the cure. In fact, the missing propulsion, they believed, had finally been found. The success against childhood leukemia, and more recently Hodgkin's disease, stood out as proofs of principle. the first hesitant explorations of a vast, unexplored space. Cancer, like the moon, was also a landscape of magnificent desolation, but a landscape on the verge of discovery. In her letters, Mary Lasker began to refer to a programmatic war on cancer as the conquest of inner space as opposed to outer space, instantly unifying the two projects. The moon landing thus marked a turning point in the life cycle of the cancer crusade. In the past, the Laskerites had concentrated much of their efforts on political lobbying in Washington. When advertisements or posters had been pitched directly to the public, they had been mainly educational. The Laskerites had preferred to maneuver backstage, preferring political advocacy to public advocacy. But by 1969, politics had changed. Lister Hill, the Alabama senator and one of Mary Lasker's strongest supporters, was retiring after several decades in the Senate. Senator Edward Kennedy, Farber's ally from Boston, was so deeply embroiled in the Chappaquiddick scandal. In July 1969, a car carrying Kennedy and a campaign worker veered off a Martha's Vineyard bridge and sank underwater, drowning his passenger. Kennedy pleaded guilty for leaving the crime scene and received a suspended sentence. That he had virtually disappeared into legislative oblivion. The Laskerites were now doubly orphaned. "We're in the worst," Lasker recalled. "We're back to a phase that we were in the early 50s, when we had no friend in the Senate. We went on constantly, but no effective sympathy." With their voices now muted in Washington, with little sympathy in the House and no friend in the Senate, the Laskerites were forced to revamp the strategy for their crusade, from backstage political maneuvering to front-stage public mobilization. In retrospect, that turn in their trajectory was well-timed. The success of Apollo 11 may have dramatically affected the Laskerites' own view of their project, but, more important perhaps, it created an equally seismic shift in the public perception of science. That cancer could be conquered, just as the moon had been conquered, was scarcely a matter of doubt. The Laskerites coined a phrase to describe this analogy. They called it a moonshot for cancer. A moonshot for cancer. The relationship of government to science in the post-war years is a case in point. Without very much visible deliberation, but with more solemnity, we have in little more than a decade elevated science to a level of extraordinary influence in national policy. And now that it is there, we are not very certain what to do with it. William Carey, 1963. What has Santa Nixon given us lately? New York Times, 1971. On December 9, 1969, on a chilly Sunday morning, a full-page advertisement appeared in the Washington Post. It would run in the New York Times on December 17th. "Mr. Nixon, you can cure cancer. If prayers are heard in heaven, this prayer is heard the most. Dear God, please, not cancer." Still, more than 318,000 Americans died of cancer last year. This year, Mr. President, you have it in your power to begin to end this curse. As you agonize over the budget, we beg you to remember the agony of those 318,000 Americans and their families. We ask a better perspective, a better way to allocate our money to save hundreds of thousands of lives each year. Dr. Sidney Farber, past president of the American Cancer Society, believes we are so close to a cure for cancer. We lack only the will and the kind of money and comprehensive planning that went into putting a man on the moon. If you fail us, Mr. President, this will happen. 1 in 6 Americans now alive, 34 million people, will die of cancer unless new cures are found. 1 in 4 Americans now alive, 51 million people, will have cancer in the future. We simply cannot afford this. A powerful image accompanied the text. Across the bottom of the page, a cluster of cancer cells was loosely grouped into a mass. Some of these cells were crumbling off that mass, sending a shower of metastatic fingerlings through the text. The letters E and R in cancer had been eaten through by these cells, like holes punched out in the bone by breast cancer. It's an unforgettable picture, a confrontation. The cells move across the page, almost tumbling over each other in their frenzy. They divide with hypnotic intensity. They metastasize in the imagination. This is cancer in its most elemental form, naked, ghoulish, and magnified. The Times ad marked a seminal intersection in the history of cancer. With it, cancer declared its final emergence from the shadowy interiors of medicine into the full glare of public scrutiny, morphing into an illness of national and international prominence. This was a generation that no longer whispered about cancer. There was cancer in newspapers and cancer in books, cancer in theaters and in films. In 450 articles in the New York Times in 1971, in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Cancer Ward, a blistering account of a cancer hospital in the Soviet Union, in Love Story, a 1970 film about a 24-year-old woman who dies of leukemia, in Bang the Drum Slowly, a 1973 release about a baseball catcher diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, in Brian's Song, the story of the Chicago Bears star Brian Piccolo, who died of testicular cancer. A torrent of op-ed pieces and letters appeared in newspapers and magazines. One man wrote to the Wall Street Journal describing how his family had been plunged into numb agony when his son was diagnosed with cancer. "Cancer changes your life," a patient wrote after her mastectomy. "It alters your habits. Everything becomes magnified." There is, in retrospect, something preformed in that magnification, a deeper resonance, as if cancer had struck the raw strings of anxiety already vibrating in the public psyche. When a disease insinuates itself so potently into the imagination of an era, it is often because it impinges on an anxiety latent within that imagination. AIDS loomed so large on the 1980s, in part because this was a generation inherently haunted by its sexuality and freedom. SARS set off a panic about global spread and contagion at a time when globalism and social contagion were issues simmering nervously in the West. Every era casts illness in its own image. Society, like the ultimate psychosomatic patient, matches its medical afflictions to its psychological crises. When a disease touches such a visceral chord, it is often because that chord is already resonating. So it was with cancer. As the writer and philosopher Renata Seletzel described it, a radical change happened to the perception of the object of horror in the 1970s, a progression from the external to the internal. In the 1950s, in the throes of the Cold War, Americans were preoccupied with the fear of annihilation from the outside, from bombs and warheads, from poisoned water reservoirs, communist armies, and invaders from outer space. The threat to society was perceived as external. Horror movies, the thermometers of anxiety in popular culture, featured alien invasions, parasitic occupations of the brain, and body snatching. "It came from outer space," or "The Man from Planet X." But by the early 1970s, the locus of anxiety, the object of horror, as Seletzel describes it, had dramatically shifted from the outside to the inside. The rot, the horror, the biological decay and its concomitant spiritual decay was now relocated within the corpus of society, and by extension, within the body of man. American society was still threatened, but this time, the threat came from inside. The names of horror films reflected the switch. The Exorcist. They came from within. Cancer epitomized this internal horror. It was the ultimate emergence of the enemy from within, a marauding cell that crawled out of one's own body and occupied it from the inside, an internal alien. The Big Bomb, a columnist wrote, was replaced by the Big C. When I was growing up in the 1950s, it was the bomb. This thing, the bomb, belonged to a generation of war babies. But we are fickle even about fear. We seem to have dropped our bomb phobia now without in any way reducing the reasons for it. Cancer now leads this macabre hit parade. The middle-sized children I know seem to think that death comes not with a bang, but with a tumor. Cancer is the obsession of people who sense that disaster may not be a purposeful instrument of public policy, but a matter of accidental, random carelessness. These metaphorical shifts were more powerful, more pervasive, and more influential than the Laskerites could even have imagined. The Times ad represented a strategic realignment of power. By addressing their letter to the president on behalf of millions of Americans, the Laskerites performed a tactically brilliant about-face. In the past, they had pleaded to the nation for funds for cancer. Now, as they pleaded for the nation for a more coordinated attack on cancer, they found themselves colossally empowered in the public imagination. The cure for cancer became incorporated into the very fabric of the American dream. To oppose big spending against cancer, one observer told the historian James Patterson, was to oppose mom, apple pie, and the flag. In America, this was a triumvirate too powerful for even the president to ignore. Impatient, aggressive, and goal-driven, the president, Richard Milhouse Nixon, was inherently partial to impatient, aggressive, and goal-driven projects. The notion of science as an open-ended search for obscure truths bothered and befuddled him. Nixon often groused that scientists didn't know a goddamn thing about the management of science. Nor was he particularly sympathetic to open-ended scientific funding. Corn-fed and fattened on increasingly generous federal grants, scientists, often called nuts or bastards by members of his administration, were thought to have become arrogant and insular. Nixon wanted them to shape up. For Nixon, this shaping up meant wresting the control of science out of the hands of academic nutcases and handing it over to a new cadre of scientific bureaucrats, science managers who would bring discipline and accountability to science. The replacement of Nixon's science advisor, Lee DeBridge, a scholarly old-school atomic physicist from Caltech, with Ed David, an impulsive, fast-paced engineer-turned-manager from the Bell Research Labs, was meant as a signal to the scientific community to get into shape. David was the first presidential science advisor to emerge out of an industrial lab and to have no direct connection with a university. His mandate was to get an effective science operation that would redirect its energies toward achieving defined national goals. What scientists needed, what the public demanded, was not an endless frontier, a la Vannevar Bush, but a discipline with pragmatic frontiers and well-defined ends. Lasker's job, then, was to convert the already converted. In 1969, deploying her typical strategic genius, Mary Lasker proposed that a neutral committee of experts called a Commission on the Conquest of Cancer be created to advise the president on the most efficient strategy to mount a systematic response to cancer. The commission, she wrote, should include space scientists, industrialists, administrators, planners, and cancer research specialists, entrusted to outline the possibilities for the conquest of cancer for the Congress of the United States at whatever cost. Of course, Lasker ensured that there was nothing neutral about the commission, eventually called the Panel of Consultants. Its members, chosen with exquisite deliberateness, were all Lasker's friends, associates, and sympathizers, men and women already sold on the war on cancer. Sidney Farber was selected as the co-chairman, along with Senator Ralph Yarborough from Texas. Yarborough, like Lester Hill, was one of the Lasker's oldest allies in Congress. Solomon Garb was appointed on account of his book. Joseph Birchenell was brought in from Memorial Hospital. James Holland from Roswell Park. Henry Kaplan from Stanford. Benno Schmidt, a partner in a prominent New York investment firm and a major donor to Memorial Hospital, joined the group. An energetic organizer, Schmidt was eventually asked to replace Farber and Yarborough to head the panel. That Schmidt was a Republican and a close confidant of President Nixon's was a marked plus. Politics, science, medicine, and finance were thus melded together to craft a national response. To reinforce the facade of neutrality, Yarborough wrote to Mary Lasker in the summer of 1970 asking her to join, although he scribbled at the bottom, "Your letter should have been the first mailed. It was your genius, energy, and will to help." The panel's final report, entitled The National Program for the Conquest of Cancer, was issued in the winter of 1970, and its conclusions were predictable. In the past, when the federal government has desired to give top priority to a major scientific project of the magnitude of that involved in the conquest of cancer, it has, on occasion, with considerable success, given the responsibility for the project to an independent agency. While tiptoeing around the idea, the panel was proposing the creation of an independent cancer agency, a NASA for cancer. The agency would start with a budget of $400 million. Then its allocations would increase by $100 million to $150 million per year, until by the mid-1970s it would stand at $1 billion. When Schmidt was asked if he thought that the country could afford such a program, he was unhesitant in his reply. "Not only can we afford the effort, we cannot afford not to do it." On March 9, 1971, acting on the panel's recommendation, Ted Kennedy and Jacob Javits floated a Senate bill, S-1828, the Conquest of Cancer Act, to create a National Cancer Authority, an independent, self-governing agency for cancer research. The director of the authority would be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, again underscoring an extraordinary level of autonomy. Usually, disease-specific institutes such as the National Heart Institute were overseen by the NIH. An advisory board of 18 members would report back to Congress about progress on cancer. That panel would comprise scientists, administrators, politicians, physicians, and, most controversially, lay individuals, such as Lasker, Foote, and Bobst, whose sole task would be to keep the public eye trained sharply on the war. The level of funding, public scrutiny, and autonomy would be unprecedented in the history of the NIH, and arguably in the history of American science. Mary Lasker was busy maneuvering behind the scenes to whip up support for the Kennedy-Javits bill. In January 1971, she fired off a cavalcade of letters to her various friends seeking support for the independent cancer agency. In February, she hit upon another tactical gem. She persuaded her close friend, Ann Landers, her real name was Epi Lederer, the widely read advice columnist from Chicago, to publish a column about cancer and the Kennedy bill, positioning it exactly at the time that the vote was fermenting in the Senate. Landers' column appeared on April 20, 1971. It began solemnly, "Dear readers, if you are looking for a laugh today, you'd better skip Ann Landers. If you want to be part of an effort that might save millions of lives, maybe your own, please stay with me. How many of us have asked the question, if this great country of ours can put a man on the moon, why can't we find a cure for cancer?" Landers' answer to that question, echoing the Laskerites, was that cancer was missing not merely a medical cure, but a political cure. If enough citizens let their senators know they want Bill S-34 passed, It will pass. Vote for S-34, she pleaded. And sign your name, please. Even Landers and Lasker were shocked by the ensuing blizzard of mail. I saw trucks arriving at the Senate, the journalist Barbara Walters recalled. Letters poured in by the bagful, about a million in all, pushing the Senate mailroom to its breaking point. One senator wrote that he received 60,000 letters. An exasperated secretary charged with sorting the mail hung up the sign, "Impeach Ann Landers," on her desk. Stuart Symington, the senator from Missouri, wrote to Landers begging her to post another column advising people to stop writing. "Please, Epi," he begged. "I got the message." The Senate was also getting the message. In June 1971, a modified version of the Kennedy-Javits bill appeared on the floor. On Wednesday afternoon, July 7th, after dozens of testimonies by scientists and physicians, the motion was finally put to a vote. At 5:30 that evening, the votes were counted. 79 in favor and 1 against. The swift and decisive victory in the Senate was precisely as the Laskerites had planned it. The cancer bill was now destined for the House, but its passage there promised to be a much tougher hurdle. The Laskerites had few allies and little influence in the lower chamber. The House wanted more testimony, and not just testimony from the Laskerites' carefully curated panel. It solicited opinions from physicians, scientists, administrators, and policymakers. And those opinions, it found, diverged sharply from the ones presented to the Senate. Philip Lee, the former Assistant Secretary of Health, complained, "Cancer is not simply an island waiting in isolation for a crash program to wipe it out. It is in no way comparable to a moonshot, to a Gemini or an Apollo program, which requires mainly the mobilization of money, men, and facilities to put together in one imposing package the scientific knowledge we already possess. The Apollo mission and the Manhattan Project, the two models driving this war on cancer, were both technological achievements that stood on the shoulders of long and deep scientific discoveries, atomic physics, fluid mechanics, and thermodynamics. In contrast, even a cursory understanding of the process that made cells become malignant was missing. Seizing on the Laskerites' favorite metaphor, Saul Spiegelman, the Columbia University cancer scientist, argued, "An all-out effort at this time would be like trying to land a man on the moon without knowing Newton's laws of gravity." James Watson, who had discovered the structure of DNA, unloosed a verbal rampage against the Senate bill. "Doing relevant research is not necessarily doing good research," Watson would later write. "In particular, we must reject the notion that we will be lucky. Instead, we will be witnessing a massive expansion of well-intentioned mediocrity." Others argued that the notion of a targeted war on a particular disease inevitably distracted from natural synergies with other arenas of research, forcing cancer researchers to think inside the box. An NIH administrator complained, "In a nutshell, the Act states that all NIH institutes are equal, but one, the NCI, is more equal than the others." Yet others argued that the metaphor of war would inevitably become a distraction. It would whip up a froth of hype and hope, and the letdown would be catastrophic. "I suspect there is trouble ahead for research in cancer," Irvin Page, the editor of a prominent scientific journal, wrote. "People have become impatient with what they take to be lack of progress. Having seen what can be achieved by systems analysis, directed research, and great coordinated achievements such as the moonwalk, they transfer the same thinking to the conquest of cancer all too readily." This bubble would inevitably burst if the cancer project stalled or failed. Nixon, meanwhile, had reached the edge of his patience. Elections were fast approaching in 1972. Earlier that year, commentators such as Bob Weidrich from the Chicago Tribune had laid down the stakes. If Richard Milhouse Nixon can achieve these two giant goals, an end to the war in Vietnam and defeat of the ravages of cancer, then he will have carved for himself in the history of this nation a niche of Lincoln-esque proportions, for he will have done more than put a man on the moon. An end to the war in Vietnam was nowhere in sight, but a campaign against cancer seemed vastly more tractable, and Nixon was willing to force a cancer bill, any cancer bill, through Congress. When the ever-resourceful Schmidt went to visit him in the Oval Office that fall of 1971, in part to propose a compromise, Nixon reassured Schmidt that he would finagle or strong-arm a solution. "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of that." In November 1971, Paul Rogers, a Democrat in the House from Florida, crafted a compromise cancer bill. In keeping with the Laskerites' vision, Rogers' bill proposed a vast increase in the budget for cancer research. But in contrast to the Kennedy-Javits bill, it proposed to sharply restrict the autonomy of the National Cancer Institute. There would be no NASA for cancer. But given the vast increase in money, the focused federal directive, and the staggering rise in hope and energy, the rhetoric of a war on cancer would still be fully justified. The Laskerites, their critics, and Nixon would all go home happy. In December 1971, the House finally put a modified version of Rogers' bill to a vote. The verdict was nearly unanimous, 350 votes for and 5 against. A week later, a House-Senate meeting resolved minor differences in their bills, and the final legislation was sent to the President to sign. On December 23, 1971, on a cold, windswept afternoon in Washington, Nixon signed the National Cancer Act at a small ceremony in the White House. The doors to the state dining room were thrown open, and the president seated himself at a small wooden desk. Photographers parried for positions on the floor around the desk. Nixon leaned over and signed the act with a quick flourish. He handed the pen as a gift to Benno Schmidt, the chair of the panel of consultants. Mary Lasker beamed forcefully from her chair. Farber chose not to attend. For the Laskerites, the date marked a bittersweet vindication. The flood of money authorized for cancer research and control, $400 million for 1972, $500 million for 1973, and $600 million for 1974, a total of $1.5 billion over the next 3 years, was a monumental achievement. If money was frozen energy, as Mary Lasker often described it, then this, at last, was a pot of energy to be brought to full boil. But the passage of the bill had also been a reality check. The overwhelming opinion among scientists, outside those on the panel of consultants, was that this was a premature attack on cancer. Mary Lasker was bitingly critical of the final outcome. The new bill, she told a reporter, contained nothing that was useful that gave any guts to the Senate bill. Humiliated by the defeat, Lasker and Sidney Farber withdrew soon after the House vote from the political world of cancer. Farber went back to Boston and nursed his wounds privately. Lasker retired to her museum-like apartment on Beekman Place in New York, a white box filled with white furniture, and switched the focus of her efforts from cancer to urban beautification projects. She would continue to actively campaign in Washington for health-related legislation and award the Lasker Prize, an annual award given to researchers for breakthroughs in medicine and biological sciences. But the insistent, urgent vigor that she had summoned during the two-decade campaign for a war on cancer, the near-molten energy capable of flowing into any federal agency and annihilating resistance in its course, dissipated slowly. In April 1974, a young journalist went to Lasker to ask her about one of her many tulip-planting proposals for New York. At the end of the interview, the reporter asked Lasker about her perceptions of her own power. Was she not one of the most powerful women in the country? Lasker cut the journalist short. Powerful? I don't know. No. If I were really powerful, I'd have gotten more done. Scientists, too, withdrew from the war, in part because they had little to contribute to it. The rhetoric of this war implied that its tools, its weapons, its army, its target, and its strategy had already been assembled. Science, the discovery of the unknown, was pushed to the peripheries of this battle. Massive, intensively funded clinical trials with combinations of cell-killing drugs would be heavily prioritized. The quest for universal causes and universal solutions, cancer viruses among them, would be highly funded. We will, in a relatively short period of time, make vast inroads on the cancer problem, Farber had announced to Congress in 1970. His army was now on the march, even if he and Mary Lasker had personally extricated themselves from its front lines. The act, then, was an anomaly, designed explicitly to please all of its clients, but unable to satisfy any of them. The NIH, the Laskerites, scientists, lobbyists, administrators, and politicians, each for his or her own reasons, felt that what had been crafted was either precisely too little or precisely too much. Its most ominous assessment came from the editorial pages of the Chicago Tribune. A crash program can produce only one result. A crash. On March 30, 1973, in the late afternoon, a code call, a signal denoting the highest medical emergency, rang through the floors of the Jimmy Fund building. It sounded urgently through the open doors of the children's clinic, past the corridors with the cartoon portraits on the walls and the ward beds lined with white sheets and children with intravenous lines, all the way to Brigham and Women's Hospital, where Farber had trained as an intern, in a sense retracing the trajectory of his life. A group of doctors and nurses in scrubs swung out toward the stairs. The journey took a little longer than usual, because their destination was on the far end of the hospital, up on the 8th floor. In the room with tall, airy windows, they found Farber, with his face resting on his desk. He had died of a cardiac arrest. His last hours had been spent discussing the future of the Jimmy Fund and the direction of the war on cancer. His papers were neatly arranged in the shelves all around him, from his first book on the post-mortem examination to the most recent article on advances in leukemia therapy, which had arrived that very week. Obituaries poured out from every corner of the world. Mary Lasker's was possibly the most succinct and heartfelt, for she had lost not just her friend, but a part of herself. "Surely," she wrote, "the world will never be the same." From the fellow's office at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, just a few hundred feet across the street from where Farber had collapsed in his office, I called Carla Reed. It was August 2005, a warm, muggy morning in Boston. A child's voice answered the phone, then I was put on hold. In the background, I could hear the white noise of a household in full tilt. Crockery, doorbells, alarms, the radio blaring morning news. Carla came on the phone, her voice suddenly tightening as she recognized mine. "I have news," I said quickly. "Good news." Her bone marrow results had just returned. A few nodules of normal blood cells were growing back, interspersed between cobblestones of bone and fat cells. Signs of a regenerating marrow reclaiming its space. But there was no trace of leukemia anywhere. Under the microscope, what had once been lost to cancer was slowly returning to normalcy. This was the first of many milestones that we would cross together, a moment of celebration. "Congratulations, Carla," I said. "You are in a full remission." Part 3. Will you turn me out if I can't get better? Oft expectation fails, and most oft there where most it promises, and oft it hits where hope is coldest, and despair most sits. William Shakespeare, All's Well That Ends Well. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid.